Hello and welcome to the Convex Conversation with me, journalist Helen Fosbero. Today I'm at a community centre in South London to meet personal trainer Patrick Hutchinson, the man who was photographed carrying a white demonstrator through the crowds to safety at the Black Lives Matter protest in London back in June. The powerful image of Patrick with the man draped over his shoulder was taken by photographer Dylan Martinez from Reuters and went viral, making headlines all over the world. Patrick has since been featured on the news, he's writing a book, made the front cover of Men's Health, shot a piece for GQ magazine, has been nominated for a humanitarian award, and is using that newfound, unexpected platform with the friends he was with that day to fuel positive change by creating an organisation called UKI, which stands for United to Change and Inspire. Patrick, we've spoken on the phone. It's fantastic to meet you in person. The last few weeks have been a complete whirlwind for you, haven't they?
Yes, they have been. Nice to meet you too, Helen. Nice to put a face to the voice over these conversations we've been having. Yes, it's been a crazy, crazy time these last few months. And for someone at my age, it's not what I quite expected. I thought it would be time to sort of relax and play with the grandchildren at this stage in my life. But obviously, the higher power has other things planned for me. So, yeah.
So how has June the 13th changed your life?
It's been absolutely incredible. I never thought that, you know, one act like that would absolutely turn my life upside down. Locally, a lot of people recognise me, so I've got to try and keep a low profile, which is getting, you know, more difficult to do. I've done many, many interviews and podcasts like what I'm doing with you today. I've been on all the main media outlets, myself and my group of friends, UKI. I've done, as you mentioned, lots and lots of magazines and stuff. Being aligned with some various brands, which will be coming up. And obviously I'm writing a book. So yeah, my life has literally been turned on its head, generally for the better, I would say.
It's extraordinary to think, isn't it, Patrick, that acts like yours probably happen lots during life, but are not captured in the way that Dylan's captured you. It was that photograph really, wasn't it, that's given you this amazing opportunity to make some positive change.
Yeah, it's that one moment. I'd like to think I've lived my life in a way where I've probably done quite a few things in my 50 years that potentially, if caught on camera, would have made headlines. But this particular thing has, and the impact it has when it does, it's unbelievable. I still can't really fathom how it's got so much publicity. You know, I do get that it was quite a kind act, but I still struggle to understand the enormity, shall I say, of the whole situation and how it's just gone viral and seen the world over.
So take us back to June the 13th. Why did you and your friends decide to go to the demonstration in the first place?
Well, we decided to go because we felt that after that rant that was put out there by the EDL member, we felt that it was our duty to go out there and help protect and support the community, especially the youngsters going out there who can be quite volatile. So we thought it would be good to go out there as elder, wiser heads to oversee what was happening. We put a few call outs amongst the community. I think we only had six of us turn up on the day, really. I think a lot of people felt it was a trap, it was set up, and don't go down there, it's been called off. But we knew that some of our youngsters would still go out there. And so we wanted to go out there and make sure that they didn't do anything too untoward and stayed out of trouble.
And what was the atmosphere like?
It was very hostile in places. In Trafalgar Square, where we sort of met up as a group along with other protesters. It was nice to see so many young people out there, you know, fighting for their rights, so to speak, and making their voices heard, as well as some of the older guys that we know that have made it up there. But obviously when you got to where some of the demonstrations were happening and where you could see the far right extremist protesters, it was quite volatile and there was a lot of anger and hate.
So describe the actual incident that Dylan captured on camera. What actually happened?
So when it comes to the actual incident, that was after most of the protesting and confrontations had taken place. And the police had sort of chaperoned everybody towards Waterloo. And then there's an area outside Waterloo train station, which has a staircase leading up to the embankment. So it was in that area that this incident took place. There was a bit of a skirmish. a clash between some of the far-right protesters and some of the Black Lives Matter protesters at the top of the staircase leading up to the embankment. And it seemed as though some of the far-right protesters had run off afterwards, and there was left just one guy left there, and he looked quite drunk, you know, quite intoxicated, and almost didn't know where he was. And then there was a few of them that held him up. They were just sort of holding him up because he could barely stand up. And then they were passing him down the stairs. And then a few of the more volatile protesters got wind of, you know, who he was and what he might have stood for and wanted to start to attack him. There was a Rastafarian guy that was there that, you know, he was probably in his 50s or something, that was stopping people from hitting him, was protecting him, shielding him. And we were sort of watching from a distance. And we saw that, you know, this wasn't going to end well. We could see that more and more people had noticed what was happening and were congregating to the area. And it was getting thicker and thicker with a crowd of people, and more people were coming and coming. So we had to get over there quickly because we knew that, you know, the Rastafarian guy, and there was a few others as well helping him to protect him, it was only a matter of time before they couldn't protect him anymore. The crowd got thicker. We rushed over there. And then this guy was obviously, we were on the way over, so we didn't know how he ended up from one place to another. But then he was on the steps of the floor, and then there was loads and loads of people over him, some trying to stop people from hurting him and some people trying to bring harm to him. And I was like the last one of us to sort of get over there. So the only thing left for me to do was to pick him up and get him out of there. So, which I did, hoisted him up onto my shoulder, like in a fireman's carry, and started marching him over towards the police. There was a row of police a few feet away, and they were filming what was going on. And whilst I was carrying him, you know, people were protecting us because you could still feel blows, him receiving blows while I was walking away with him. And then once I sort of got away from the main area of danger, there was a lot of clapping and applauding going on. So there were lots of people, you know, lots of the Black Lives Matter protesters, we were just up there applauding us for what we'd just done. So that was quite a nice feeling. At this moment in time, I didn't realise there were people filming or taking pictures or anything like that. I just put him down in front of the police and said, here you go. And then we moved on to the next incident.
Did he say anything to you?
No. He was completely and utterly out of it. I mean, he may have been slightly concussed, you know, as well as being drunk, but he just didn't know what was going on.
He's been identified now. I mean, you've been all over the world's press. Has there been any contact? Has he tried to get hold of you to say thank you?
No, I've heard nothing from him.
What went through your mind when you scooped him up and you threw him over your shoulder? What was going through your mind at that moment?
At that particular moment in time, nothing was going through my mind other than saving him some serious harm and also just saving the Black Lives Matter protest and the narrative. Because if something bad had happened to him, it would have just, you can imagine the press and the negative story that would have been written about what had happened.
So how did you realise, what was the first moment you realised that that had been captured on a still and suddenly you were in the spotlight?
The first time I realised is after we'd left the protest and made our way back, we travelled down to Clapham and North, sort of at the end of Cole Harbour Lane. And there's a spot called Eat of Eden. We do eat there quite frequently. My friend Chris, one of the UK, his friend runs it or owns it. And we went down there for a bite to eat. And while we were there eating, our phones started like sort of popping off, and mine in particular. And I had a message come through from my sister. And funny enough, but prior to that, on the way down, I had put in a group chat that I have with my siblings that I had saved a white guy's life today or something to that context. And no one thought much of it. Like, you know, what's Patrick going on about now, probably?
You didn't put hashtag national hero.
No, I didn't put anything like that, no. My sister messaged me with a picture. Is this you, Pat? Like, and I said, yeah. And she sent me some video footage. She said, like, oh my gosh, this picture is going viral. I think it's on Reuters feed. It's going all over. It's all over the world. People are ringing my phone and stuff. And I said, really? She said, yes. Like, what's going on? What's happened? And I said, well, that message I sent to you earlier, this equates to that. This is what we did. She said, oh my God, it's just like, it's out of control. Like, have you seen the views on Reuters feed and stuff? So I said, okay, I'm going to put it on my Instagram page. I just said, like, it's not black versus white. It's everybody versus the racists. And I just wrote that. It just came to mind and I wrote it. And it seems to now be sort of my phrase. And it's almost like the title of my book as well now. And yeah, put that up. And then I started getting hits and follows and hits and follows. And yeah, my Instagram account went from about, I think it was like 1.9K to 22K.
Wow. And did your family and your kids and stuff feel really proud of what you'd done?
Yeah, they were. My mum was extremely proud. And my children, yeah, extremely proud. But my mum especially, she said, you've always been like that as a little boy and you've always wanted to help people and, you know, you'd always be the kind of guy that would befriend the child that no one was friends with and stuff like that. So it doesn't surprise me at all.
So you suddenly now, Patrick, have this unexpected, newfound platform to make a really massive and positive difference. Tell us about you, Kai, and how the idea for it came about.
So the idea for you, Kai, came about when we all sat down and decided that this is an opportunity. I mean, we'd all individually already been doing work with children in the community. Jermaine Facey, I've known him for over 25 years. And he worked in Brixton Recreation Centre. I used to train in the gym and he used to work there. I always used to see him letting in children in the back door, children that just couldn't afford to go into the recreation centre. He would let them in and let them train and let them play football and do stuff with them for nothing. I don't know, it was about £3 or £2 or whatever to get in, but the children just didn't have that. They just couldn't afford it. But he would let them in. And he's been doing stuff like that for years without any reward. And myself, I coach young sprinters. And I've coached football as well in my earlier days and trained children as well, you know, for fitness and stuff. And I work in a few schools also doing coaching, athletics coaching. So it came to us as, well, why don't we just use this now as a platform and let's just help the children in our community and try and make a difference in society as a whole with this platform that we have now. So that's how we decided. And then obviously we just thinking of inspirational names for the group. Fathers for Change was the first one that we quite like that still, but we felt it might neglect the mothers who are probably the main and strongest characters in our community when it comes to raising the children. So we didn't want to just use the word fathers. So in the end, we came up with United because, you know, we were united on the day as brothers, fathers, and as parents to go up there and help to take care of our community and the children in our community. And we changed the narrative, that negative stereotype that they like to put on us at times. You know, when you see a black guy in a hoodie or whatever, they think that you're up to no good or think that you're aggressive or whatever. All the negative stereotypes that are out there about us, we've liked to think that we've helped to change that narrative. And then we're inspiring other people, other children, other individuals to be like us and be a force for unity and for change. We want everyone to have that same outlook on life and together we can make a big difference.
I love the fact that each of you in UKAI are specialising in different areas and playing to your strengths. And I love the stories behind each speciality, if you like. So Jermaine, I think, tells the moped story and he's going to take care of the criminal justice system area. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, so Jermaine will be focusing on criminal justice. I mean, he's the main guy, but we'll all be party to it and be helping as well. So, you know, he'll be going into a lot of prisons. We will be going to a lot of prisons, spending time with inmates, doing talks, doing uplifting stuff, trying to lift morale. Especially, I think he wants to particularly work with the young offenders in various young offenders institutions like Feltham's, where the boys are still boys. They're still only boys and they're in there. And their life is on that path. It's a chance to get in there and stop them from continuing that life of crime and get in there now and show them that people still care about you, society still cares about you, and this is not the end. This can be the start of a new beginning for you if you just make the right choices in life. So he's going to be going into a lot of those institutions and will be doing talks and uplifting and trying to make changes in those areas.
And he, when I mentioned the moped, he tells a story, doesn't he, where he's got a hoodie on and he's riding his moped, yeah, and constantly stopped by the police, yeah, for no apparent reason,
no apparent reason.
Than the fact he's black and, yeah, they want to know what he's up to.
Yeah,
I mean, that really shocks me to the core, and you guys must experience that all the time, I'm,
yeah,
guessing.
Yeah, I mean, and also we'll be trying to champion some sort of change as well. Obviously, we want to go to Parliament for various changes to be made because obviously we believe that the system is unfair. The scales are unbalanced against us, and you know, when a young black boy goes up in front of a judge, often the result isn't the same as if he was white. So we want to address all these things as well.
Chris is going to be focusing on mental health. I know you're all going to be helping with each other's areas as well, but why is mental health particularly pertinent to Chris?
Yeah, well, for Chris, admittedly and openly says that he suffered a mental breakdown. He worked in the city for many years in the corporate sector, and he suffered a lot of unconscious bias and stuff. And he was due for promotions and didn't get them. And he was treated differently than his white counterparts. So that's his area because he feels really passionate about that. And he's got various qualifications around mental health as well, mentoring people with mental health issues. So that's his area and he'll be championing that.
And Lee is concentrating on youth development and mentoring. Tell me a bit about Lee.
He's an interesting character. Actually, him and Chris are the sort of same age, are the youngest guys in the group. He had some issues growing up as well, didn't have his father around, and he has twin girls and he has a son, and he's a wonderful father. And it was just natural for him to, I mean, we're all wonderful fathers, a lad, but for him, it was just natural for him to go into that area because, yeah, he's really, really good with children and he really cares about the future of our young children, especially the young men. And he has a son who is, I think he's about 11 or so, his son. So he really cares about his son's future and he just feels like youth development is something he can make a huge change in.
And for you, what will your area be?
And mine will be education. So again, you know, I'm used to working with children. I want to work not only, but predominantly I'd like to work in the PRUs, which are pupil referral units. So these are children who have been kicked out of mainstream schools because of probably behavioural issues, etc. After a PRU, potentially the next stop could be leaving school or the education system altogether and ending up in a gang or something. So I really think that going into the PRUs is going to be really important to avert that happening. And as well as mainstream schools, I'll be going to mainstream schools as well to do talks and do fitness programs and stuff like that. But the PRUs are my main point of contention. And along with that, you know, I want to try and champion a bit more Black history, not just on October. We'd like it added into the curriculum. So that would be one of the things I'll be pushing for.
It's very important, isn't it, that Black history does go into the curriculum now. And as you say, it's not just this one month.
Yes, and we also want to make sure that, you know, Black people are not just seen as ex-slaves. There's quite a strong history in Africa before colonization and slavery and all the rest of it, and we need that taught as well to help empower young Black children. When I was at school, I did struggle with the slavery side of things, and it played on my mind a lot, and I couldn't fathom how to feel about it. So I think it's important to empower young children, let Black children especially, and let them know that you're not just descendants of slaves. You know, before that, you were doing great things and slavery is a consequence of the Europeans coming over and deciding to do what they did. But you're not just descendants of slaves, you're descendants of great people. And I think it's important that we spread that word.
And those achievements and the celebratory achievements aren't really talked about, are they?
No, they're not. They're not mentioned enough. And individuals that did great things are not mentioned enough. So we need to help empower young Black children to let them know that they are coming from greatness. And also teach young white children as well that Black people weren't just slaves. We were coming from some majestic backgrounds and royalty and all sorts. A lot of things that people don't know about Black history that needs to be taught.
And growing up, Patrick, did you and your friends experience a lot of racism? I mean, has it been a struggle through your teenage years being a young Black man?
Yeah, through my teenage years, I did. It's funny because at the time, you kind of just get on with it. You just get on with life. It becomes a part of society and it's a part of life. And on numerous occasions, I experienced racism from my own white friends. One day you're this, and then the next day they're knocking for you to come and play out, and you go and play out. And these things have an effect on you, but it's almost like it's normal everyday life, and you sort of get on with it. But as you get older, you realise that this stuff isn't right, and it's not fair. So yeah, there was lots of things that happened growing up. Some stuff is mentioned in my book as well.
You did the front cover of Men's Health, photographed by a great friend of mine, photographer Chris Floyd. And one thing you talked about in that Men's Health article was training and how exercise has been really important in your life. The martial arts have been really important and saved you mentally, I think you've been quoted as saying.
Yeah, training and martial arts, fitness, sports, all of these things saved me mentally. I can't imagine if I hadn't had those things in my life where I would be today, because I think people, they always align health and fitness and stuff with making you look good physically. And yes, they're the first things that people see if you work out or if you train. the first thing they probably see is that you look in good shape. But I think the mental side of it is totally underestimated, and I feel it's probably more important than even the physical side. The endorphins and the dopamine and all that, those releases in your brain when you work out, it leaves you feeling really, really good. That feeling that you have after a workout, it lasts for quite some time, a few hours after. People need to understand that you're not just working out physically, it's mentally too. So that is why, I always champion physical fitness and health and all these things, because sitting around at home and getting depressed about whatever the case may be, like the current things that are happening in the world right now, you can't sit around moping about them, because at the end of the day, these things are not going to change, right? Not overnight anyway. So the best thing to do is just get out there and get training and do some exercise.
And you found a love for that very early. Didn't you used to watch kung fu movies when you were a little boy?
It started off with me watching kung fu films and mimicking the moves and breaking a few lampshades in the process, doing jumping, flying kicks and stuff. But that's where it all started, yeah. And I still love kung fu films up to this day.
And in what way, when you say you feel it saved you, in what way do you feel it saved you?
I've had various trying times in my life, and I have friends who have had mental breakdowns. I've had friends who have died. And when I look at my life and I say to myself, why didn't I have a mental breakdown? Why did I not go down that particular route? Everything goes back to fitness and health and training. It all goes back. You know, I was too busy training and playing sports to get myself involved in drug taking or gang activity or illegal stuff. When I've had trying times in my life, struggles, a couple of hours in the gym, a couple of hours training, playing football, whatever the case may be, it takes you away for that period of time. It takes you away from the trials and tribulations of life just for a moment. And that's all you need each day to keep you on the right track.
We can hear some lovely voices in the background, and I think that's because chicken casserole is about to be served in the community centre. So if people are listening, that's the hubbub of people getting served, I think, their lunch. What about your childhood? What sort of family do you come from? How many siblings? What was growing up like, and where did you grow up? There's a million questions there, it all rolled into one.
So I was born in Coventry, but I didn't stay up there that long. Came down to London about the age of 4, I think. And I was raised by a single mom with my sister, Paulie. There was 3 of us, and a lot of love and a lot of affection from our mother, but she was by herself. So there were times where we had to be left alone, or left with the neighbours while she went out to work. She did 3 jobs. How she did it, I do not know, but she's literally a superwoman. Then around the age of 16, 17, I found I had other siblings, and then there's a whole load of us. So I have 4 boys altogether, including myself, and there's about 6 girls, if I'm not mistaken. So we're really, really close, all of us, most of us, should I say. And you wouldn't believe that we all had different mothers, because a lot of us look alike. And my father or dad had obviously strong genes. But I mean, if there's one thing he did do that I respect him for, even though he didn't raise all of us, I know he raised some of us, is that he picked really, really good mothers for his children, because that is why today we are so close, because we've all been raised really, really well.
And are you really inspired by your mum?
Yeah. She's my superhero. Yeah.
In what way?
It's just that when I think back at how she managed to never let us miss out on anything, whatever it was, she made sure we had it. How she was able to do 3 jobs. I mean, she used to wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning. I used to remember all of this, but you don't really realize at the time what's happening. But she used to wake up at 4 in the morning. No, wake up at 3 in the morning. She used to start at 4 in the morning and do a cleaning job and get back to get us ready for school, and then take us to school. And then whilst we were at school, did another job. And then we would make our way home, because it was only just down the road, our primary school. And then she'd get back, give us dinner, and then go back out to work again in the evening. And then we would sort of get ourselves ready for bed, and she'd come back. So she did 3 jobs. It's just, the mind boggles at how you manage to do that.
And I bet she never complained.
No, and she still managed to spend time with us, like on the weekends, show us lots of love and affection. She never seemed angry or cross or, except when we did naughty things. But she's the greatest woman I've ever known, in my life.
I'm sure there's a place for her in your book. Tell us a bit about the book and the sort of thrust of it.
Yeah, so the book is called Everybody Versus Racism, A Letter to My Children. It is me writing to my children and grandchildren, but it's really to society. That's the format of the book. And it's just sort of a lot of my take on things in today's world and what's happening. There's lots of references to various things that have happened to black people. There's, you know, some anecdotes of me and my life and growing up and stuff. Not a whole load, but there's, you know, there's a few bits about me growing up and my family. Yeah, it's just generally my take on things, and hopefully people find it an interesting read.
And do you talk a bit about George Floyd and Black Lives Matter and your thoughts on where that's going or whether it's losing any impetus?
Yeah, I touch on all those subjects. Yeah, I touch on, yeah, I do, yeah.
And what are your thoughts, Patrick, on that?
I feel, you know, I'm not a member of Black Lives Matter, the movement. I'm more about the statement, Black Lives Matter. I've always said I feel it's almost an insult to society that we actually physically have to say Black Lives Matter, because why should we? It should be an obvious statement, right? Just like when people say all lives matter, yeah, it's an obvious statement. But for Black lives, it doesn't seem so obvious when you see what's happening in the world over here and especially in America. So the fact that we have to champion this, it's, to me, it's a bit of an insult to society that we have to do this. But as a whole, I feel like there's still lots of momentum. I feel that the movement Black Lives Matter have given us a huge platform, and I'm grateful for that platform. And now it's for individuals to do what they can do to fight for some proper lasting change and equality for us.
You mentioned there things that are happening in America. I mean, in the last few days, there have been massive demonstrations in Kentucky after Breonna Taylor's death and the fact that she was lying in bed. Her house was raided by police. She ended up being shot dead, and none of the police officers are being prosecuted for manslaughter or murder. I mean, does your heart sink, Patrick, when day by day, it doesn't matter what day of the month, what day of the year it is, there's another of these stories in the press?
Yeah, it does. I'm just a total bewilderment as to how these verdicts have come to. And the thing I struggle with, and we struggle with as a whole, is that, you know, especially United to Change and Inspire, we're here trying to unite everybody, and we're trying to inspire everybody to just come together. And the powers that be seem to be totally against that. It's almost like they're trying to start a race war or something, because there's only one race, the human race. But they'll have you believe that we're all different and black people don't matter and white people are superior. And it's almost like they're trying to instigate some sort of war between us all. But those of us that know better know that there's strength in numbers and we need to come together, because it's the only way out of this troubled time that we have.
When you look at your grandchildren, you still look far too young to me to have grandchildren. When you look at them, how hopeful and how optimistic are you for them that things will be different and that they won't have to go through some of what you've all been through?
I have to be hopeful and optimistic, because if you don't have hope and optimism, then what have you got? So I have to be hopeful. Otherwise, I would be depressed to think that, no, things are not going to be any better for them and I'm going to die and leave them in a world of absolute mayhem and hurt. But no, I have to think that if we continue to champion these causes and fight for what's right, then ultimately, when they're older, their life will be a lot better and more improved than ours was. It is a long and slow process, it seems like. But if we look back, have there been improvements? Yes, there has, as a whole. So we can't say there hasn't been, obviously, but there's just still so much more to be done. But yeah, hopefully for them, they won't have to worry about this fight anymore, let's hope. They'll just be judged on the content of their character, just like Martin Luther King says.
I think there's a lot of weight on your shoulders now, Patrick. You have this golden opportunity to make a difference. And what does fill my heart with joy is the speed with which you're being recognised. You know, I don't mean you personally in a way, but that your efforts are already being recognised. I mean, you were telling me on the way into the community centre today that you've been nominated for a humanitarian award. That, to me, seems really, really positive, that that photograph was taken a few weeks ago and everybody wants to hear from you. And how did you feel about that award? I mean, that, to me, feels very special.
Yeah, that, to be nominated for a humanitarian award is huge. I'm humbled, really, to think that people would think I'm that guy. It's just a nice feeling to know that. I think I was saying to you outside when we spoke earlier that I like to think that good guys can come out on top eventually in life, because sometimes you feel like when you are a person that does good and it goes unnoticed, and that's fine because we don't do it for the likes, do we, or to be noticed. We do it because that's who we are. That's what makes us who we are. But when you are recognised every now and again, it is nice to sort of take a bow and think, you know what, thank you. I do deserve this because I have been a generally good person throughout my life, and good people do come out on top sometimes.
Patrick, it's been a pleasure to come and meet you today. I'm looking forward to meeting Chris, Jermaine and Lee at some point, hopefully. You're united as brothers and fathers, united for change. And it's really wonderful to see you taking this newfound platform and doing something to provoke positive change. So I hope you'll keep in touch. And if there's anything I can do to help, then just shout out, because I think we should just all get behind you, Kai, and help you with what you're trying to do. I mean, presumably, do you want people to join and get in touch and help?
Yes, I mean, things that people can do, you can fund organisations that are trying to improve the lives of not just black people, but everybody, the impoverished, because this is not just an issue about colour, it's also a class issue as well. And, there are impoverished and white people who are struggling in society too. So it's not just a colour issue, it's a class issue. So, we like donate to those charities that are doing good work. Obviously, do your research, donate to the likes of UKAI, champion petitions that you see come through that are trying to make change, and do what you can. Go out there, protest, do whatever you can to add some fuel to the fire and keep it burning.
You've been listening to Patrick Hutchinson, whose selfless act at the Black Lives Matter protest back in June has given him and his friends a chance to bring about positive change for the community. Thanks very much for listening to The Convex Conversation. We're on Spotify, Apple and Google Podcasts, or at convex.podbean.com. So do tell your friends and family about us and share the link. I'll be back next week with another fascinating guest. So thank you very much for your company today. Bye for now.